Okay, today we're going to talk about self-harm. I hope by now that you have had a chance to watch the videos about from the intervention episode. I know those were not easy. That was not an easy episode to watch. You certainly get a sense of the of how painful self-harm is, and how deeply embedded it is in family dynamics. Historically, most of the students that I've debriefed that video with have come away with a great deal of anger at Tamara's father, and that would be really good for us to talk about that in the forums. It is a pretty graphic portrayal of spiritual abuse that you see unfolding in real time. But I want to focus on the self-harm part of things for now, and we'll the presentation for next time will be on spiritual abuse, and we can continue talking about it after Jeff Van Vonderen gives us some input on the nature of spiritual abuse. The whole topic of self-harm, I think most people approach it experiencing an enormous amount of confusion. I mean, it's why would anybody do that? I think it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. Why do people hurt themselves? Now, there's a lot of ways to answer that question. I'm going to hint at some of them today. I think it's worth noting that in a culture that is a relatively violent culture, it shouldn't be particularly surprising that some of that violence gets in some people gets directed at themselves. We live in a kind of no pain, no gain culture, and there's lots of forms of self-harm that are culturally acceptable, I suppose, if you call it that. You know, body art is... well, I consider it universally to be a desecration of sacred space, is understood by lots of people to be a form of artistic expression. Medically unnecessary cosmetic surgery seems to me to be a form of voluntary self-mutilation, but it's seen by some people in our culture as a kind of improvement, even though it's sort of obviously involves damage to tissue and so on. We have a lot of sports that are quite violent, a lot of high-risk behaviors that are rewarded and so on. So there's a lot of the level of violence that's out and about in entertainment and other parts of culture is pretty high. And in a culture that has a long history of being a violent culture, America's kind of an adolescent culture. It's only been around a couple hundred years, so we're still kind of impulsive the way adolescents are. And we have to make the same mistake more than once in order to figure out what in the world we're doing wrong. Even then, sometimes are quite confused about that. But I think it's also true, and I think for our purposes important to note, that there's lots of religious ideation that sometimes gets hooked into self-harm. And there are many people who find themselves in relationship with gods that cause pain for a variety of reasons. And gods who reinforce the value of deprivation, for example, the mortification of the flesh and sort of self-loathing and particularly body hostility. I think there's many parts of the Christian tradition in the West where you find quite staggering amounts of body hostility towards the body, and you could trace this, I suggest, starting with Augustine and working your way through, where you'll find lots of in Augustine, sort of semi-Manichaean instincts about the body as being the problem. And we're the inheritors of that tradition, and it would not be too surprising in a tradition where the body is the problem you would find some hostility towards the body. And for some people, that would wind up being expressed as different forms of self-harm. Let me begin, though, really by looking at a bunch of myths about self-harm. There's a lot of just misinformation out there about self-harm. First is that self-harm is just an attempt to get attention. Now all of us need attention, so all of us do things to acquire attention. I don't, in principle, think of that as necessarily a bad thing, but just a normal life skill, that finding appropriate ways to get our needs for attention met. And the danger here is not so much that self-harm, which is obviously, I think, an attempt to get attention, is that it becomes a rationale for minimizing or dismissing the significance of self-harm. If it becomes, oh, you're just trying to get attention, then you have sort of this is a reason why people might not pay attention. And then and that sort of myth that self-harm is just about asking for attention is can be a pretty dangerous, because you won't see it, you won't recognize it for what it is. The same is true, and it's just an extension of the same sort of instinct, really, to suggest that self-inflicted harm is an attempt to manipulate other people, and it certainly can be an attempt to manipulate other people. But the danger here is that leaning into that way of understanding self-harm can lead to, again, to a kind of minimizing and instinct to resist that manipulation, and it reinforces our already existing predisposition not to pay attention here, because it's painful. I mean, remember how you felt when you watched the video. It's very painful, and there's an instinctual protective mechanism in us to sort of withdraw from that, which is exactly the opposite of what is really needed. A third instinct is that people who self-injure are crazy. They're just, it's a form of insanity, because normal people would never do such things. Let me just suggest to you that if you wind up working with a number of people who self-harm, you'll find this challenged fairly early on. I'm not suggesting that people who self-harm don't have often very significant mental health issues of other kinds. But self-harm per se doesn't strike to me, I think because to an observer it looks so bizarre and unintelligible. Like, I just can't imagine why anybody would do that. But if you were well informed about self-harm, I think you'd say, well, under the circumstances I can see why people might behave in this way. It doesn't... It's not totally insane, it's sort of an inappropriate response, but an intelligible response to the experiences that they're having. And I'll talk more about that in a bit. But again, the real danger here is to dismiss it as, just so crazy that there's no way that I can possibly be involved or be helpful. This is, someone needs to go to a residential treatment facility somewhere to get help for this, because, it's really, really crazy. Again, that's the dismissive instinct. It's another way in which we cloak our anxieties and our fears about engaging with people who are struggling in life. Fourthly, the instinct that if the wounds aren't bad enough, self-harm isn't serious. Now, let me suggest that self-harm is always serious. It's always meaningful behavior. It's always very inappropriate behavior. And to say, well, it's not serious enough, observing, for example, that it doesn't appear to be suicidal and we're just going to wait until it's suicidal to have a serious response to it, I think is really misguided. It's sort of this myth that it's something that, sort of a stage that people go through. I don't buy that at all. I think it's an orientation to life that could go on and express itself in a variety of ways throughout an entire lifetime. So it's a very significant problem, and it is something that we can really be helpful to people who are struggling with this. Finally, the notion that it's only teenage girls that self-harm. Remember, I can't remember which lecture it was, I talked about the very pronounced gender specificity about normative responses to sexual abuse among teenagers, that people respond to sexual abuse of girls very differently than they respond to sexual abuse of boys, including some significant proportion of the population who think that the boys got lucky and are completely unable to see the harm done to adolescent boys who are sexually abused. You see that same kind of gender specificity in the area of self-harm. If you have an adolescent girl who's into self-harm, let's say cutting or other forms of self-harm that we'll talk about later, the instincts are, this is crazy. They need serious help. Let's get them to a treatment program where professionals can intervene, and so on. And perhaps we lead with empathy and understanding, but this is a this is a problem. And with adolescent males who self-harm, the instinct is very different. You might actually acquire a spot on on TV. There was a recent episode of America's Got Talent that featured a guy whose talent was that you could kick him in his genitals as many times as you were inclined to do, and it didn't bother him at all. So he had a series of his friends come on stage and kick him in the genitals and put a brick block on his groin, had someone break the block with a sledgehammer, and it was received by the judges as extremely positive. He was advanced to the next round, and the audience just thought this was spectacularly entertaining. So males engaged in self-harm, in this case sexual self-harm, even if it was just simulated self-harm, he may have had a steel plate in there, I don't know. But self-harm tends to be rewarded, is treated as entertainment. After all, if the star high school football quarterback has a concussion in the first quarter and he's back playing in the third quarter, at very significantly increased risk for traumatic brain injury, a lot of people would be inclined to say that's the kind of leadership and courage that we'd like to see. So it's associated with positive qualities among males, whereas in females, it's universally thought to be pathological. Again, when you start to see really dramatic gender specificity of responses, I think it suggests that we're part of a culture that really doesn't understand what's going on with adolescents, doesn't understand that same sort of dynamic could be at work in both genders, just expressing itself in different ways. All right, just a word about different kinds of self-harm. Cutting is probably what people think of most frequently when they think of self-harm, and you saw the video with Tamara, you had a sense of what that's like, the extraordinary amount of pain associated with it, and the multiple, we'll talk in a bit about the multiple ways of understanding that. But there's lots of other things, burning and scarification, piercing, different sorts of wounds. I was in a piece in the news a while back about a guy who you could go to who would shoot you with different caliber weapons so that when the wound healed, you'd have a war story to tell. Oh, I got this in Nam, and that kind of thing. So it's sort of quite a dramatic example of self-harm as a fashion choice, as a sort of accessorizing one's life with a fanciful narrative. Pretty troubling kind of thing. Self-deprivation, as in anorexia or other kinds of deprivation, could certainly fit in the category of self-harm. It's withholding nourishment. It's a little bit different dynamic, but there's a lot of self-harm dynamic to anorexia. Hair pulling and things like that is not uncommon form of self-harm, as it is a compulsive plastic surgery. It's kind of a cliche, but there's a good deal of it. After all, once you buy into the notion that someone can do something to your body to make you liked, a kind of addictive process can be at work there, because it never really solves the anxiety you have about being liked. Because now, if someone does like you, you're not sure whether they really like you because of you, or whether they just like the surgically altered you. And so, in all probability, the more surgery you have, the more anxiety you have. It does, it's sort of the surgery is marketed as a solution to the problem of body anxiety. But in all probability, it just increases the amount of body anxiety one has, the more surgery that one pays for. And then there are different forms of religiously sanctioned self-harm. It's far easier to see this, of course, in someone else's faith tradition. You think of Shiites going on pilgrimage and lashing their backs with whips to cause harm and pain and blood. And rather more difficult to see it in one's own tradition. And we will be coming back to that a little bit later. So there's a lot of different kinds of self-harm. There's a series of issues that I'll talk a bit about how complicated self-harm is. As it never comes as kind of a single issue, there's a lot of other things involved. One that does have a place in popular understanding of self-harm has to do with a link with sexual abuse. You remember Tamara's boss at the welding shop said what happened to you as a child. There was that sort of instinct down to the welding shop level that this kind of behavior has deep roots, and it often does. I think it's important to know that although a substantial percentage of people who engage in self-harm have histories of childhood abuse, most people who do engage in self-harm do not have childhood histories of abuse. So it's not really diagnostic for childhood sexual abuse, for example. There's a link there. It's a complication, but childhood abuse is neither necessary nor sufficient to cause self-harming behaviors. There's a second issue worth mentioning is there's an enormous disagreement about whether self-harm is in fact a suicide risk or whether it is a kind of anti-suicidal behavior. That is, here's the question. When someone engaged in self-harm, are they doing this sort of regulated and controlled and limited self-harm in order to prevent themselves from going further down that pathway and engaging in fatal self-harm? And there are people who, you know, lean towards seeing the functional usefulness of self-harm in preventing suicidal behaviors, and others who say, no, you know, anything down that path is down that path. And you know, so I don't know that any of these people would encourage self-harm, but it is, I think, and everybody, I think, would recognize that there's certainly a difference between self-harm and suicidal behaviors. Most of the sorts of behaviors we're talking about here are not even suicidal gestures, even the cutting. There was nothing suicidal about Tamala's very precisely controlled efforts to create pain. Third issue worth just mentioning, because it will kind of come up, you'll find yourself thinking about it, is that there does seem to be a kind of an addictive process at work to self-harm. There is a loss of control where it sort of becomes not just one of the things you do to manage stress in your life, but it becomes the primary thing and eventually the only thing. And a lot of the elements of the addictive process can be observed in people who self-harm. To say nothing of the fact that, as in the case of Tamil again, there's a coexisting problem with substance abuse, in her case alcoholism, and who knows what all else. Fourth issue that I hear particularly people in pastoral roles express concern about is whether there's a contagion factor about self-harm. And the concern is this, that, you know, maybe we shouldn't even talk about this, because if people learn that this is a way to function in life, maybe more people will adopt it. It'll have kind of a fattish kind of cloth. Now, I think that this is a legitimate fear, actually. I think that the worst possible response to this fear is to not be talking about this. It is silence that sustains systems where self-harm becomes an option for people. So if there is in fact a contagion, all the more reason for us to get this out in the open, to be talking about it, to be providing resources to people, giving them access to resources that are available, providing them alternative ways to navigate the very complex and painful experiences that people have experienced in life. I mean, this is the last thing we want to do, if there is in fact a kind of fad effect, is to hope it goes away by closing our eyes about it. That will not be successful. Okay, and then finally, fifth point, there's, self-harm rarely occurs all by itself. There's typically anxiety disorders, substance abuse, often eating disorders, and very often depression as part of the package. And so it needs not just a response to the specific behaviors, but some sort of sensibility that this is part of a whole package of how someone's life has gone off the tracks here. And they need a lot of different kinds of interventions to find a healthier way to be in the world. Now, I want to emphasize that there's a kind of cycle to self-injury, because I think it helps us think about different occasions where intervention might be helpful. It all begins at the top of this diagram with some sort of emotional suffering, and it could be any kind of emotional suffering. It could be, have some of the elements of post-traumatic stress disorder, flashbacks, intrusive memories, but it could also be more not quite so much trauma-related. It could be related to sort of a deeply embedded self-loathing or body hostility that causes suffering related to the body. And what happens is that kind of suffering, emotional suffering, tends to accumulate over time until you experience a kind of what I'm calling emotional overload. It's like it's too much. And it's a very particular kind of emotional overload because it has two poles to it. Either you're so emotionally overloaded that it feels like you can't feel anything anymore. Like you're kind of globally numb. I mean, so numb that you don't feel anything, and you know that people who are alive actually feel things and you can't feel anything. You're not sure whether you're alive. It's a very terrifying kind of experience to be that numb and that shut down. But the next minute, the next hour, you might switch to feeling the emotional overload might express itself in almost the exact opposite way, where it feels like overload. It feels like you're ready to explode because you feel so much. So you go back and forth between these two poles of, feeling nothing and then feeling it all at once. And that's a very exhausting sort of flip-flop to be experiencing. To feel nothing and feel all the pain at once. In both cases, having nothing that you can really do about this, no tools, no resources to do anything with that. And what happens eventually is, I think that you get a lot of anxiety about that. What am I going to do about feeling numb, sort of globally numb? Feeling nothing, almost like you don't exist, and feeling everything all at once, either too numb or too intense. And what happens is that it crescendos to a kind of panic, anxiety becomes the most prominent feature, and that's the point at which people tend to act out with self-harm behaviors. It may be a way of demonstrating to myself that I can still feel. I'm not numb, at least I can feel this pain. And it may also be, I'll talk about other reasons why people might do self-harm in a bit, but the important thing to recognize by the acting out behavior, the self-harm behavior, is that it tends to work. It does result in temporary relief of the suffering. You know, the good news about that is that there is temporary relief. The bad news about that is not just that it's temporary relief, it doesn't last very long, but the consequences of the temporary relief leads directly to an increased shame about this, feelings of guilt, feelings of hopelessness, like I'm stuck in this cycle, there's nowhere to go, I'm just doing this again, I didn't want to do this again, I don't know what to do, which feeds back into the emotional suffering that started the whole cycle. Now, there are ways to be helpful at every point in this cycle, right? At the level of emotional suffering, there's resources, there's ways to be helpful. As people's panic and anxiety increases and their heightened anxiety and panic makes them at risk of acting out behavior, there are strategies that might be able to help people identify people at that point. Sort of, you know, when you find yourself at high risk, you call your sponsor. Other kinds of strategies could be put in place to help with that. Hotlines for people who are at that state can be very helpful interventions. And after self-harm, with that shame and grief, finding ways to respond to the aftermath of self-harm behavior becomes really important. Because typically what people do is that they increase people's shame and guilt and grief at that time, which just speeds up the cycle. And if you find some ways to be graceful, to be compassionate, to be understanding, even if it's behavior that you don't understand, you sort of lean into gracefulness, I think you'd find that would be very, very helpful intervention in this cycle. All right, let me talk about motivations for self-harm, because I think this is the piece that's sort of most confusing, particularly to pastoral care providers. It just, you know, and when things just seem unintelligible to us, we tend to get anxious, and our interventions often wind up being a treatment for our own anxiety rather than focused on the person that we really want to help. So let me see if I can clarify the motivations. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'll talk about 6 possible ways of in which self-harm behaviors make sense. So they're at least intelligible. None of these makes them self-harm inappropriate behavior, but it makes them hopefully an intelligible behavior. The first is to see self-harm as creating pain that is evidence that I exist. Now, this is clearly a very existential notion, but lots and lots of people, I think Tamala in the video talked about not knowing that she existed. I just can't feel. And you know that people who are alive can feel things. Well, here's a way that I can feel things. Here's concrete evidence that I, you know, have quiddity, that I exist, that I'm somebody. Even if it's somebody in pain, it's better than not being at all. Secondly, and this I think was very clear in Tamala's case, that self-harm is a kind of affect modulation. It's sort of a way we can regulate our affect. If we're it can distract us from unwanted affect. Here she has this enormous pile of resentments and suffering that she's accumulated from childhood that's causing her staggering amounts of pain. And here's a way to distract herself from that pain. And the advantage, there are several advantages, to the pain of self-harm over the pain of unexamined and unprocessed childhood abuse, for example. In Tamala's case, the self-harm is an intelligible pain, right? I hurt because I cut myself. I understand that. This other pain that's sort of nebulous and unexamined and unprocessed, I don't know what that is, but this makes sense. And a pain that makes sense may be quite attractive to people who are experiencing a pain that doesn't make any sense at all. It may feel like a preferable form of pain. In addition, it is a, well, I'll make that point later. So self-harm can be stood as an effort to respond to pain that I can't control and I don't understand by creating pain that I can control and I do understand. And that's, you know, not a good choice, but at least it's an intelligible choice why someone might choose to do that. Thirdly is, and Tamil expressed this among many people who do self-harm, there's this sense that I deserve to be punished. I have been bad. And I need to be purified. In Tamil's case, that was very associated with images of blood and sacrificial language. A very confused and disordered sensibility about that, but this sense that I deserve pain. And often you'll find people stating this very explicitly, this is what I deserved. I am dirty, I am I don't deserve pleasure in life. I deserve bad things too. And I think someone who's deeply convinced of the truth of that is very likely to find stuff in the Christian tradition, conceivably even find stuff in your sermons that reinforce that very distorted concept. Because the Christian doctrine of sin, a bedrock, very important principle for the Christian faith, can be turned into just, I'm bad. And that's not a very accurate reflection. It's certainly not a robust biblical notion of sin. It's just mistaking self-loathing for the doctrine of sin, which is much more a much more graceful, I would argue, sensibility about the problems that we have to face. If this were a systematics class, we'd spend a whole lecture on that, but I can't do that. Fourthly, another way to think about self-harm, and sometimes it's very helpful, is that people are trying to express in action stuff that they have no words for. And this isn't particularly pronounced among people whose self-harm is, in fact, related to childhood sexual abuse or other childhood trauma, where, you know, when you hurt a kid has no language for this. They just know they may not know anything, right? It's so unintelligible. It's what some people call unexperienced experiences. After all, if we experience something, something happens, for us, for example, to remember that, we have to process that experience into a form that can be stored in our memory. And that processing usually requires that the experience be intelligible in some way, because it's a kind of a cognitive processing that goes on. Now, we can remember things as body memories without a lot of cognitive processing, but often traumatic experiences that are completely unintelligible, you have no words for, you can't cognitively process this at all, may not get stored at all. They may get stored as body memories. They may not get stored at all. But you might find yourself acting in ways that are an attempt to express something that's there somewhere, deep in you, and cannot find words for, cannot find healthier ways to name that. Trying to find a way to experience unexperienced experiences. I don't know whether that language would be helpful to you or not. I found it to be helpful in some cases. That sort of took in 2 points there. Finally, I want to say a bit about the issue of control. One of the things I think you see in the video about Tamala is this exquisite level of controlled pain. This is a pain that she's in charge of. She can decide exactly how much pain she experiences. And there is about that a kind of returning to the scene of the crime, which is her body, but in a way where you're in a much more powerful role. If you're going to get hurt, you're going to be able to regulate that. And this might not always be a helpful way to construe the motivation for self-harm, but it's not uncommon for people who have been abused to return to the scene of the crime, typically their bodies, and to do so in a way where they're protecting themselves, oddly and paradoxically, protecting themselves from experiencing pain that is unintelligible. It's okay, you know, to experience pain that I can control. I know exactly how much, and I'm much more powerful here because I am the one who's in charge. That means they're playing both the role of abuser and victim in this little drama, which is pretty troubling. But I think for some of you that might be kind of narrative that makes the self-harm at least more intelligible. It doesn't make it more appropriate. It just makes it more intelligible. And the more intelligible self-harm is, I'm thinking the more likely it is that we'll be able to engage other people in conversations about it and, you know, talking about different options that might be less harmful than what they're doing now. Okay, a few things about how to be helpful. It's pretty easy to come up with things that aren't helpful. Go back and watch the Tamala video and look at everything her stepfather does if you want to know what's not helpful. One thing that, and I think I have 5 things that contrast between what's helpful and what's not. Panic, shock, calling 911, overreacting. I don't like that expression very much because it's appropriate to react, and who knows what overreacting is. But the key is, here's someone who's full of anxiety, acting out of their anxiety, and the issue is whether I'm picking up a bunch of that anxiety myself. And if what I do when someone I care about is really anxious is I absorb a bunch of that anxiety, we're both going to be anxious. We're both going to be doing counterproductive things. And what I need to do, what I typically do, and what certainly most codependents typically do, and lots of other people as well, is if I've picked up a bunch of anxiety from this person who's harming themselves out of anxiety, I'm going to try to manage my anxiety. And how am I going to manage my anxiety? I'm going to try to get you to change. I try to get you to change your behavior. And this is profoundly counterproductive. It's going to increase the anxiety in the person who's engaged in self-harm behavior. And it's not really going to reduce my anxiety at all. So what might help is finding some way to stay calm. It's not easy to do, but at least that's sort of taking ownership of my own anxiety and finding appropriate ways to manage my own anxiety. Maybe the person who needs to get help here is me. Because this stuff, I can't seem to live in a healthy way with this stuff. What am I going to do? Where can I find more appropriate ways to manage my anxiety than doing things that in the end winds up being hurtful to this person? Again, it's been my experience that most of the time when you are working with the family where there's self-harm, particularly among adolescent girls, that you enter that kind of frame thinking that the adolescent girl is maybe the sickest person in the family system. And after a while, you notice the fact that maybe not. Maybe there's other people here whose psychological pathologies at least equal, if not excel. Often parents, and I speak as someone who has been pretty close to this, if you could get mom or dad to get some help for themselves, that might be just as powerful an intervention as doing whatever it takes to get the kid to get help for themselves. At the very least, mom and dad will now be modeling appropriate behavior in response to uncontrollable anxiety. They're going to ask for help. And kids will notice that. They'll say, well, that's not a shaming thing. I'm glad you got help for yourself. And after a while, they may think, maybe I could do that too. You know, it's just sort of modeling positive ways to go here. Second thing that doesn't help is responding about ideas, attempting to control behavior with rewards and punishments, all that kind of control stuff. And you saw this in the video with Tamil's dad, who had all these theological points that he wanted to make. She didn't engage with that at all, and I think quite appropriately so. But there's nothing about argumentation that's going to be helpful here. Now, Tamala's stepdad argued that fundamentally we are thinking beings, and behavior always is a reflection of our ideation. A clearly modernist notion, I would argue. Again, this is not systematics. I've got to avoid this stuff. What would be helpful in rather than ideas and argumentation is acknowledging the pain. I mean, ideas become one of the sort of classic ways we avoid leaning into the emotional suffering. Let's talk about things instead of feel things. And making room for the suffering, making it clear that it's okay to be in pain and to talk about it, creating safe spaces where people can do this, a safe family space where it's possible to negotiate complex emotional realities. All of that is going to be a much healthier response to someone in this kind of pain. The third thing that's very unhelpful is really moralizing, telling them they shouldn't do that, telling them God doesn't want them to do that. Even if it's true, if you go back and watch Tamala's stepdad, you'll find that most of the things he said are things that I would agree with. You know? Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. You should, notice the word should, you should take care of that temple. Well, the problem is not with the idea there. I agree with the idea. The problem is when true things are used as vehicles for communicating shame, which is what he was doing. He was loading as much shame as he had a capacity to do, quite unconsciously, having not really worked on his own issues, apparently. He was quite unconsciously loading all these true statements with as much shame as they could carry and transferring that shame to his stepdaughter. It would be far better to simply listen. Can you tell me something about your experience? I would love to listen. A very different stance to take, much more challenging in many ways, much more demanding, requiring you to have done some work on your own issues. But making space for other people's anxieties rather than trying to use these occasions to treat our own anxieties is the key to being helpful here. Telling people to try harder, praying harder, or whatever is, it's just not gospel stuff. It's not Christian stuff. The Christian message is not about try hard. It's just not. It's about when you come to the end of trying, and none of the trying makes things work. There are resources still available because God is still here. He hasn't run away. He hasn't hid himself from this suffering. And but we tend to, in situations like this, again, where anxiety is triggered, is to tell people very counterproductive things. Trying harder to not do some behavior It's just like telling an alcoholic, you need to try harder to not drink. You know, every alcoholic I've ever known has tried that. They've all made the decision not to drink anymore. They probably tried that many, many times. It's just never been successful. So trying harder doesn't work with this kind of suffering. And if all you've got in your theological bag, bottom line, is try harder, I just encourage you to ask yourself whether there isn't some more graceful material in the text that you might be able to dig into, both for yourself and for other people. So telling them that you care about them and you respect them in spite of the suffering would be a much more graceful response rather than encouraging people to try harder. Finally, there is a I don't know how to characterize this, but hoping for the best, referring them and then disengaging. This is not an uncommon behavior you see among pastoral care providers. You get yourself in a situation, it feels pretty deep. It's, you know, you're over your head, you're feeling anxious, and so you refer and cut, right? And that is experienced by people in really very negative ways. It's really important to stay engaged. A phone call at 3 months, 6 months, and a year, how are you doing? Can you? I've been praying for you this whole time, and I hope you're doing okay. Is there anything else that I can do to be helpful? You certainly do want to refer someone who is deeply engaged in self-harm and confused by that cycle of anxiety. Need someone that they can talk to on a regular basis about this. They need someone they can talk to more regularly than they can see someone in a pastoral role. So you need to, you know, it's pretty obvious, but you need ahead of time to have educate yourself about all the resources available in the community for this kind of thing, so you have some sensibility about where you could refer somebody. You know the national hotlines, you know the local resources, you know treatment centers, you know different kinds of resources available for people who struggle in different ways with this kind of stuff. My own sensibility about pastoral responsibilities here is that it doesn't, that a pastor is not just a community mental health worker. That is, we're not out there on the front line to make referrals to the longer term resources. That we're about the business of creating communities where it's safe places to talk about the things that are most difficult to talk about. And so finding some ways to talk about this, in a worship setting, for example, how would you talk about self-harm as part of a communion service? Well, I haven't thought that through. I've never done that. But let's talk about that in the form. How would you craft a communion service? The first thing that comes to mind is what this is about is God is here, feeding us with spiritual food. And that's the role God wants to have in our lives. We may resist nurture, but God's eager to nurture us. And so come. And I think that kind of frame for a worship service would be experienced in very positive ways by people who self-harm. That experience of God as someone who is willing to be nurturing, even in a time when they're full of anxiety and full of self-loathing, they can come, and God's presence will be a nurturing presence, not the presence of a power that shames and rejects and says you should be doing it better and you should try harder. Just a thought. All right, just to emphasize some bottom lines. Self-harm is rarely suicidal behavior. Sometimes it is. That's kind of a call above the pay grade for most pastors. You may not, because you will always know that you're seeing the tip of the iceberg here, right? People are going to come and tell you as much as they're capable of trusting you to hear, but they don't know how much you're capable of hearing yet. And so you just get little bits and pieces, and you need to act as if you're just getting bits and pieces and suggesting, you know, processes that they can engage in to move in the right direction. It's a really inappropriate behavior, but it is understandable. It's not sort of classic crazy behavior, right? And so the last thing you want to do is sort of, because what we do once you say it's crazy behavior is you kind of back off just a little bit. And just a little bit is something people pick up very, very quickly. You're moving away because you think I'm a nutcase. And anything you can do to communicate, this is, I understand how painful this is and how much you would like to have a different way of being in the world. And I'm going to be praying along that line for you, and hopefully we can find some resources that will help you move in that direction. Anything like that is going to be helpful, because that's moving a little closer. It's not moving away. Finally, the notion of referring but don't abandon. Find some way to stay connected. Now, if you're pastor of a large church, there's no way to sort of keep up with the kind of how everybody's doing it. You've referred if you've referred a couple hundred people. But the sort of way you do in that kind of situation, it becomes all the more important to think of issues like this not as isolated issues for individuals, but part of the information about the congregation that shapes how you build congregational identity and congregational life. Is it possible to talk about these kinds of things? If not, why not? Why is something that clearly affects, when in a face-to-face class I talk about this issue, I ask people who are youth pastors to raise their hands if they know somebody in their youth group who's a cutter. And you know, half the hands in the classroom go up. So this is a very, very common reality that just doesn't get talked about, and that makes the problem all the more difficult to do something about. So find some way to talk about this. Okay, I feel like I'm feeling some anxiety about not having, covered as much as I would like to cover in this lecture about this. But talk to me in the forum about this. I want to do two things at least. I want us to be able to debrief the video you watched. I would really like to know what you responded to most viscerally about that video, and what you learned about self-harm. And then any response to any of the topics I've talked about here is fair game. Thanks for watching, or listening, depending on what you're doing. I'll see you in the forums. Talk to you soon.